Welcome to the Confluence of Ideas from Confluence Investment Management. I'm Phil Adler. The war in Iran upset financial markets in the first quarter of the year, and the Strait of Hormuz remained essentially closed as the Confluence Asset Allocation Committee met recently, as it does every quarter, to consider changes in the investment mix for the firm's five model portfolios. Our guest today to discuss how the firm has rebalanced its portfolios to match its second quarter outlook for the economy and the markets is the chair of the committee, Kajsa Stuckey. Kajsa, we often remind listeners when we have these conversations that risk management is the fundamental guide for all five Confluence investment models, ranging across the risk spectrum from income to aggressive growth. How would you rate the performance of Confluence portfolios in the first quarter as war broke out?
Hi, Phil. Good to be here. You know, when the war broke out and volatility increased, the goal was not to be immune from market stress, but to have portfolios that were balanced enough to participate in the market moves and durable enough for a tail risk. For us, treasuries and mortgage-backed securities help provide ballast. And across the equity side, we're not relying on one narrow outcome. So overall, I would characterize performance as resilient. It reinforced the value of building diversified portfolios that can withstand a wider range of outcomes.
Is there anything that surprised you about the way the markets reacted to the war?
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest surprise was the initial move in gold. In a conflict involving Iran and the Strait of Hormuz, we expected higher energy prices, more volatility, and demand for safe haven assets. But gold initially moved lower, which was counterintuitive. Our view is that the move was driven less by a change in gold's strategic value and more by liquidity needs. In periods of stress, governments, institutions, and other agencies may sell what they can to raise cash, and gold is highly liquid. So we did not see that decline as undermining the case for gold. If anything, it reinforced why we hold gold as a strategic hedge, not a short-term trade. Even hedges can be volatile during a crisis.
As you said in your written report, the focus this quarter for the committee is to prepare portfolios for a post-conflict world, which opens up the question, does this process require a fairly precise timeline for the war to end? And if so, what is the committee's projection?
No, not really. We do not need a precise end date to position portfolios. In fact, trying to forecast the exact timeline of a war could be a false precision exercise. What we do need is a base case framework. Our working assumption is that the most acute phase of the conflict eventually passes, but the world that follows is not the same as the one before. Energy security, continued remilitarization, supply chain dynamics, commodity access, and fiscal support all become more important. So the question for portfolios is not simply, when does the war end? It is, what changes after the war? And our answer is that the post-conflict environment is likely to be more inflation-sensitive, more geopolitically fragmented, and more focused on fundamental underlying value.
Quoting from our conversation last quarter, Kajsa, you discussed four ways the committee manages exposure to the possible breakout of war. They were maintaining gold across strategies as a hedge and stabilizer, also holding treasuries and mortgage-backed securities as a hedge and stabilizer, then avoiding overly concentrated equity outcomes, and building portfolios to be durable against volatility across a range of potential outcomes. Now that war has actually broken out, do you tweak these strategies?
Boy, you really have a good memory. We're not abandoning those strategies. We're reaffirming them. Gold remains a strategic hedge and stabilizer. Treasuries and MBS remain important ballast. We continue to avoid overly concentrated equity exposure, and we still want portfolios that are durable across a range of outcomes. The tweak is more about emphasis. When the risk moves from a hypothetical to actual, we want to make sure the hedges are still appropriately sized and that equity exposure is focused in the areas we think are best positioned for the next phase. That is why sector positioning matters this quarter. We're maintaining equity exposure, but we're being more intentional about where that exposure sits.
In spite of the war, you continue to anticipate economic expansion and no recession during your three-year horizon moving forward. Why?
You know, because the underlying growth backdrop remains reasonably resilient, and we're not dismissing the risks. Higher energy prices, geopolitical uncertainty, and sticky inflation all widen the range of possible outcomes. But our base case is still for economic expansion. There are several reasons. Household and corporate balance sheets are not showing the kinds of broad stress that usually precede a major downturn. Also, fiscal policy is still supporting growth because a lot of the spending is directed toward real economy investment. That would be rebuilding infrastructure, strengthening defense capabilities, improving energy security, and expanding domestic manufacturing, as well as monetary policy. It's no longer moving aggressively tighter. So our outlook is constructive but measured. We're not forecasting a boom. We're forecasting continued expansion with more volatility and more dispersion across markets.
Kaisa, I'd like to move on now to the way you have adjusted second quarter portfolio allocations. First, you're boosting allocations to long-term bonds in the three most conservative portfolios at the expense of speculative grade and intermediate and short-term bonds, depending on the model. Why do you view long-term bonds more favorably right now?
You're right. Yeah, we added long-term bonds because they look more useful again as stabilizers in the conservative portfolios. Yields are more attractive than they were several years ago. And if growth disappoints or a market becomes more risk-off, longer duration bonds can provide ballast. Importantly, we do expect the energy shock to create near-term inflation pressure, and we've definitely seen that. But our view is that much of that will be absorbed over time, and that inflation will be managed over the longer term. So we're comfortable taking some duration risk, especially compared to adding lower quality credit when spreads remain tight.
Turning to the stock allocations, large caps remain dominant in your portfolios, and allocations to mid and small cap stocks have disappeared. How come?
Yeah, this is partly about fundamentals and partly about market structure. Large cap companies continue to have strong balance sheets, better access to capital, and more global revenue flexibility. In a more uncertain environment, that matters. There's also a structural support from passive flows. A large share of investor dollars continue to move into broad market cap weighted vehicles, and that disproportionately benefits large cap companies. We don't think that force will disappear quickly. Small and mid-cap valuations can look attractive, but they also tend to be more exposed to higher financing costs, tighter credit conditions, and domestic equity volatility. So for now, we think that large caps offer a better balance of quality, liquidity, and passive support.
Looking at the asset allocation changes for your portfolios this quarter, your stock allocations seem pretty stable. Is it fair to say that the real story this quarter, at least for stocks, are sector rotations you've implemented within these broad categories?
Yes, I think that's fair. The broad stock allocation is relatively stable because we still want equity exposure. We're constructive in risk over the three-year horizon. But within equities, the composition matters. This quarter is really about refining the equity exposure for the environment we see ahead. We're not simply saying own stocks. We're saying own the parts of the market that are better aligned with the macro backdrop. That includes energy because of commodity and security of supply dynamics. It includes industrials in the more risk-tolerant portfolios because of reshoring themes. And it also includes a broader approach to large caps because we think market leadership can continue to widen beyond the narrow group that dominated the prior cycle.
What then is your argument for broader participation by stocks within the large cap category?
The argument is that market participation is slowly broadening as fundamentals start to matter more. For much of the recent cycle, a relatively narrow group of mega cap growth companies carried the market. That made sense when growth was scarce and investors were willing to pay a premium for companies with durable earnings. But the environment is shifting. We're seeing more companies outside the narrow leadership group that are showing improving earnings, stronger cash flows, and more reasonable valuations. As rates stay higher than they were in the last cycle, investors are becoming more disciplined about what they're willing to pay for growth. So we still like large caps, but we do not think large cap exposure has to mean only mega cap technology and communication services. We think the other 493 can play a bigger role as earnings growth broadens and the fundamentals reassert themselves.
I noticed you've added an energy sector position across the portfolios. Does this reflect the fact that the U.S. remains an oil exporter?
Yeah. That's part of it, but not the whole story. The U.S. energy position is certainly important. Domestic production gives the U.S. a strategic advantage in a world where energy security has become more valuable. You know, just ask Europe. But the energy allocation is also about inflation protection, cash flow, and geopolitical risk. Energy companies can benefit when supply is constrained and prices remain firm, but also tend to have more disciplined capital spending than in prior cycles, which can support shareholder returns. So yes, the U.S. role as an energy producer matters. But the larger point is that energy provides exposure to a world where commodities, supply, security, and geopolitical risk are once again central to the investment conversation.
In the more aggressive portfolios, you've added an industrials position. Does this anticipate new factories and infrastructure in the United States?
Industrials are tied to several themes we think have staying power. Infrastructure spending, defense spending, reshoring, factory construction, grid investment, supply chain resilience, you name it. This is not just a short-term cyclical trade. It reflects a broader policy shift. Governments are spending more on physical capacity and energy systems, national security, and industrial resilience. That creates a supportive backdrop for selected industrial companies. We added the exposure in the more aggressive portfolios because industrials can be more cyclical. They're not the same kind of stabilizer as gold or treasuries, but for investors with a higher risk tolerance, we think industrials offer an attractive way to participate in the real economy investment cycle.
Kaisa, just a couple of more questions as we dive a little bit deeper into your recommendations. You've exited, I see, a previous position in communication services, and I wondered if this is in any way AI related.
Yeah, we exited communication services mainly as a portfolio construction decision. The sector had performed well and was tied to some of the same AI and megacap growth themes that had already become a large part of the market. This was not based on a negative view of AI. It was about reducing concentration in prior market leaders and reallocating toward areas we think are better aligned with today's backdrop.
And you've added an Asia-Pacific developed markets ETF to your mix. Is Japan leading the way? And if so, why?
You know, Japan is an important part of the story. We continue to see meaningful changes in Japanese corporate governance, their capital discipline, as well as shareholder returns. Those changes are structural, not just cyclical. Japan also benefits from several macro themes we like: developed market stability, industrial capacity, advanced manufacturing, and potential currency support if the US dollar weakens over time. So more broadly, Asia Pacific developed markets give us exposure to economies that are tied to global trade and manufacturing, but with stronger institutions than many emerging markets.
Well, we've arrived now at the commodities question. Commodities do remain key in all your portfolios and command additional space in your growth and income and growth portfolios. You added platinum to the mix last quarter for the most risk-tolerant strategies. Any additions this time around?
You're right. You know, commodities remain important in the portfolios because they help address a world of sticky inflation, geopolitical risk, and supply constraints. We continue to view gold as a strategic anchor, not just a tactical trade. It provides diversification and can help stabilize portfolios during periods of geopolitical stress. We also continue to like platinum in the more risk-tolerant portfolios. The platinum-to-gold ratio remains attractive. And the metal has favorable supply-demand dynamics. It also gives us exposure to industrial demand and potential resource scarcity. This quarter, the larger commodity emphasis is the addition of energy exposure across the portfolios, but that was in the equity sleeve. That reflects both near-term supply shock and the longer-term importance of energy security.
Kaisa, one last question, which arises as I view the way various assets performed in the latest quarter. REITs had a very good first quarter, comparatively. Do you view them favorably?
You know, we view REITs as mixed. They had a good quarter, but the asset class is still sensitive to interest rates and financing costs and uneven property fundamentals. We don't hold REITs in any of the asset allocation portfolios. For now, we see better risk-reward in the areas we emphasized this quarter, large-cap equities, developed international, as well as the sectors and factors that we talked about.
Thank you, Kaisa. If our listeners would like to read the detailed second quarter 2026 Asset Allocation Outlook Report and see all the changes in viewer-friendly charts, that's very easy to do. Just access confluenceinvestment.com. There you'll find a tab for the Asset Allocation Quarterly on the top right. Our discussion today is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice. This information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll. I'm Phil Adler.